Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
Ever heard of a popcorn-driven robot? This week on Meat & 3, we're bringing you stories about the intersection of food and tech.
We're interested in building swarms of many cheap, small robots and powering them and driving them forward with as little effort and as little energy as possible.
We cover tech by land.
Imagine if you could cut fresh microgreens onto your salad and eat it while the greens are still fresh and nutritious and delicious and alive. That dream is real.
We cover tech by sea.
We're building software-based business services to help shellfish growers manage and grow their business.
And we cover tech in the social media stratosphere.
So it's not really necessarily an indictment on food media or media consumption at all. It's how the robots decided that they were going to weight human interaction.
Tune in and get techie this week on Meat & 3, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from our studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi, ramen, izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, so I'll try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Sam Klontz, the executive kaiseki chef at Uchu in Manhattan's Lower East Side. Uchu is uniquely and deeply Japanese, despite the fact that Sam trained as a chef almost entirely in the United States. And Uchu opened in June 2017, and Sam earned his first Michelin star in that November at the age of 25. So today we'll discuss how Sam learned Japanese cuisine, how he expresses the idea of kaiseki, his new project Don Wagyu at Wagyu Sandwich Restaurant, and much, much more. But before we start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have any ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. You can email us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or kikotema.com. Now let's start a conversation with Sam Klontz. So, hello Sam, welcome to Japan Eats.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first, let's talk about your background. So where are you from and what did you eat when you grew up?
I'm from Tucson, Arizona. So I grew up there the first, until I turned 18. Growing up, it was always my mom was cooking everything. So we had, you know, fresh cooked home meals every night. And beyond that, my whole family cooked. So aunts, uncles. So I was just surrounded by home-cooked food all the time. And that kind of definitely ignited my love of food and seeing how food can just bring people together and create that sort of environment.
Mm. So, but that doesn't sound like anything. Nothing to do with Japanese.
No, not at all. there's no Japanese right at home.
Mm. So how did you get into cooking?
I mean, it definitely... I was always kind of interested in it from young age, 7, 8. Started messing around with, you know, started off like making cookies and pies and stuff. And then it kind of turned professional when I was in high school. I was in a culinary arts program in my high school. And my instructor was just one of the best kind of teachers I've ever had. the sort of teacher that I still connect with when I go back home. And he kind of helped me get my first job in a restaurant when I was 15.
So he saw something in you, interested in.
Yeah, cooking. And I mean, he was my first mentor. Mm. So I started as a dishwasher when I was 15, and then, you know, fairly quickly moved into the kitchen part of the world.
Wow.
So then just through high school, I was working full-time at restaurants and then going to school. And I knew pretty much right away that this is what I wanted to do forever.
Right. Well, by the way, which school did you go to?
I went to ICE, mm-hmm. Institute of Culinary Education.
Right, in New York.
Yeah.
Oh, that's how you got into the city of New York.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. So after you came to New York, where else did you work? You graduated from ICE and then...
Yeah, so I mean, I started in Tucson working in restaurants, and then I decided I wanted to move to New York to work in the best restaurants in the world. So I was working with the Ritz-Carlton in Tucson, and I used them to transfer out here to New York.
Mm.
And I was working there while I went to school at ICE. And then for my externship, I ended up securing a spot at Chef's Table. And that's where kind of the Japanese, I got exposed to it there the most.
Right. Well, Chef's Table, meaning the Brooklyn Fair.
Yes.
Chef's Table at Brooklyn Fair, yes. Which has a 3-star Michelin.
Yes.
And you were there for 5 years since
Correct.
2012. So I've known Cesar for a long time. He's mm-hmm. very intensely, passionately.
Very much.
Yeah. Like, he's a born to cook kind of person. So what did you learn from Cesar?
I mean, just being around him was always inspiring. I got the chance to work in a 3-Michelin-star restaurant and work with the chef every day.
Mm.
He had a kind of dedication that you don't really see at many other restaurants, where he's there every day cooking day in, day out, doesn't take a day off.
Mm.
And so, I mean, I obviously learned how to cook very much from him, but I think it was the outer things that I learned from him that were the most valuable, the attention to detail, seeing that it's not just everything that it takes to basically create the experience.
Mm, right. And as far as I understand, he has a Mexican heritage, mm-hmm. but so into Japanese cuisine, right? So how did he utilize the Japanese elements in his kitchen?
I mean, he has his own past of working with Japanese chefs and getting his own experience. So by the time I was working with him, almost everything we got was from Japan. All the fish came from Tsukiji Market, Japanese Wagyu, all the ingredients. I mean, it was very Japanese-French focused.
Right. And technique-wise, he used any?
I think it's a blend. Definitely classic French cooking, but some Japanese stuff in there as well.
Mm. Okay. Which I think is going to be, we were discussing soon, because you're a Kaiseki chef. Right. So, right. Okay. And you know, the Chef's Table at Brooklyn Fair is interesting, right? Because it's 3 Michelin stars,
mm-hmm.
and that attention and the course menu, the structure, to me, that was very Kaiseki.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, and he has a strong focus on ingredients,
mm-hmm.
not like sauces or...
Right. It's protein-focused.
Mm, right. So that's the thing, the focus on the best ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's really fun when I eat your dishes, too. Right. Anyway, so when you are at the chef table at the Brooklyn Fair, you were also in charge of the front of the house at some point?
I wouldn't say in charge,
yeah.
But I got the chance to work front of house for a few months, and it was a great opportunity for me because I got to see everything else that goes into restaurants. It's not just the food that's on the plate; it's the hospitality that you receive. It's so much more than just the food.
Mm. So I've never been a chef, so I can't see from point of view, but you cook on the plate and the end goal for you is mm-hmm. just done. right, and move on to the next production of the dishes. So what did you see, though? Like, you're serving?
Mm-hmm. Well, I got to have the, you know, personal interaction with the guests and see even more that feeling that someone gets when you cook for them. Which, I mean, for me, I've really realized throughout the years that that's why I got into cooking, is to cook for other people. Oh. It's not something that I would never cook for myself at home, but if I have someone else to cook for, I'm very happy to do it. That's where my passion comes from. Ah. It's for creating for other people.
Mm. Sounds like your family environment, exactly. Cooking for each other.
Exactly.
Mm. Right. So I'm sure that those sophisticated diners at the Brooklyn Fair, I'm sure they asked you questions.
Yeah. And since I was, I had the kitchen background, I had answered any question they might have about the food because I made it as well.
Right. Yeah, I really appreciate that, because one time I went to a fancy Chinese restaurant, and then the restaurant has a great system. Once a week, cooks come out and serve a server, and I have so many questions. And then usually, let me just ask the chef. And the server comes back, and it's like the point of the question was missed or something.
Yeah.
But that was precise, and I became a big fan of the restaurant too. So I think it should happen more often.
Definitely.
Right. Okay. So it's really the experience of serving in a dining room, and then nowadays there's a division, right? Like all the tipping service aspect, who should get paid or things like that. Do you have any idea about that?
it's a hard question these days. I don't know if there's an answer. But I think everyone needs to make a wage that they can afford to live. And traditionally, cooks have been very underpaid for how many hours they work and how physically demanding, emotionally draining the job is, that sometimes you're living in an apartment with five other people just to get by so that you can afford to work at your job.
Mm, right. So I think slowly, gradually, it's changing.
Yeah, it is. It's equalizing a little bit between the front and back house, which I think is a positive direction.
Right, because without food, there's no restaurant.
Exactly.
So it should be treated more fairly. Right. Okay. And so you completed your training in a way at the Brooklyn Fair. And you spent some time in Japan dining and studying to focus your inspiration. So where did you work and how did you find the studying position?
Through a friend that I had, his son was working in Kyoto, living there and studying, and he kind of befriended a chef at a restaurant, Kichisen, which was a 3-star, very, very traditional kaiseki restaurant. And he helped me first secure a reservation there so I could eat, and then also stage in the kitchen for a bit.
Right. So did you find any difference between, you know, there are many kaiseki restaurants outside of Japan, but what's the difference did you find?
In terms of, like, the kitchen and how it operated, it felt very familiar. That even though they were speaking Japanese, obviously, and there was a huge language barrier, it was still language of a kitchen that we could communicate. So it was kind of... It was just interesting to see that kitchen language exists all over the world. Not just New York kitchens are, not that it's run the same in Japan, but there's a lot of similarities in terms of just knowing and reading and anticipating.
Because the objectives are the same.
Exactly,
create the perfect flavor.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. But I'm curious, though, the kitchen configuration, is it very different from Japanese kaiseki and the French kitchen?
At Kichisen, what I got to see was it was still broken down very similar, where there were stations, and each station was responsible for certain things, and they all came together to create the dishes, which is essentially the same as the French brigade system.
Japanese kitchens are known for very conservative, traditional. Did you see anything?
Yeah, I mean, it was... I could tell that the chef was definitely a very strict person. They told me that he had the nickname of the General of Kyoto because of how he ran his kitchen. But everyone there was very happy to be there and gaining that experience that you only get from working with a master.
Mm, right, because it's a highly recognized restaurant. Mm-hmm. It's a Michelin, mm-hmm. right? Yeah, so what kind of menus did they serve at the Kichisen?
I mean, it's the most traditional kaiseki that I've experienced. Mm-hmm. They have some private rooms, and then they also have one counter as well.
Mm.
And it's, you know, coursed out, very seasonal things. You know, the chef goes out and gets his ingredients for that day, and that's what he cooks that night. You know, he's the one driving the van to go pick stuff up, and then he comes back with the vegetables and the seafood. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah.
Mm. So the fact that you're trained in Kyoto is probably ideal because they're full of places to get those ingredients by yourself. Right. Okay. And so as a diner, did you dine at each like private rooms?
I only dined at the counter. And then at some other restaurants there, I did some dining, some private room dining, just to see that style of service as well.
Right. Yes. Well, I just wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, for listeners who've never been to Japan and hopefully dine at those traditional places. What happens, you know, in the private dining room? It's not like private dining room in the States, right? Mm-hmm. So you don't have to make a reservation separately and for the group. But I think private dining room in Kyoto restaurant or any kaiseki formal restaurant, it's like a one-room theater.
Yeah, your reservation for the table just happens to be a private room.
Mm-hmm.
And just the style of service is so beautiful, I would say, that the way they walk in and present the food and, you know, removing the slippers before they come in and bowing when they leave. It was just beautiful to observe.
Mm, and the kimono clad.
Yeah.
And the bow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, one thing I really feel strongly about that service in that setting, private room, it's a full of respect mm-hmm. to customers and chefs and ingredients mm-hmm. and almost revered. Ingredients are respected for the season.
It's so much effort going into what you're about to eat, mm-hmm. and the focus is on that very much.
Right. And sometimes I feel guilty because you're treated like king or queen, but they have definitely strong professionalism.
Yeah, and you never feel too uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
They still make you feel at home, that you're not out of place, mm-hmm. even though you very much are.
Right. Right. Yeah, it's kind of like a trip to somewhere.
Yeah.
Right. So, okay. So, listeners, when I've been to those private kaiseki place. Because usually it's called ryote. Ryote has private mm-hmm. rooms and then sometimes garden within mm-hmm. that facility. So, it's expensive, but it's a lifetime experience.
Definitely.
Right. Okay, and so I'm sure you dined out in other places in Kyoto. Mm-hmm. So do you have any memorable dinners at a certain restaurant?
There was another one called Mizai,
mm-hmm.
Which was just so over the top with, they just threw everything at you, but it was all perfectly done, gorgeous, but like so many things on a plate, just highlighting the season perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So, did you see the difference between the place you dined out and that place, like specific sequence or just style of the dinner?
I think you saw more the chef's stylistic differences,
mm.
where they're both kaiseki, both representing the flavors of the season, but one maybe had a cleaner approach and one had more abundance, I'd say.
Mm, the composed.
Yeah.
Mm, interesting. So, which one did you like?
I don't think I can answer that.
Mm.
It's two different experiences.
Right. I think that my question is more about which style you prefer on your dishes.
I would say the cleaner style, the more simple.
Right. Kind of expected you say that because I saw it. We'll discuss about your plates later. Okay. So, any other restaurants you?
And then there was, I had another friend that kind of took me around Kyoto for a few days. And his father actually has a two-star restaurant at Sushi Nakahigashi.
Mm.
So he took me around Kyoto, which was very generous of him. And he took me to places that I don't know the name of and I could never find again.
Mm.
There was one soba restaurant that like blew me away, that still, it was like a six-course soba lunch.
Wow.
Just focus on buckwheat. And
wow.
In the like middle of summer, it was just perfect.
Right. That's energizing, cleansing, yeah, and cooling, yeah, and warming.
Like the cold dashi is just great.
Right. Yeah, by the way, Nakahigashi, his son, mm-hmm. came to the show too.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's amazing. But Nakahigashi is of the most, the greatest chef known for foraging.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And his restaurant, I think, is very hard to get to. I've never been, not to mention hard to get a reservation to.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So now let's talk about Uchu. So in June 2017, you opened a Kaiseki Bar at Uchu in Lloyd's Side with Derek Feldman, the very, very talented young business restaurateur, and Frank Cisnells, who came into the show on episode 111 and talked about beautifully about Japanese cocktail culture. So how did you guys meet and join the project?
So I met Derek through a friend that I went to culinary school with. In school, there was Dan Seehoff. We just kind of instantly became best friends. We just were on the same wavelength, kind of thought about restaurants and food the same way. And he's been my friend over the years. And then as I was getting ready to leave Brooklyn Fair, I was looking for the next step. And I talked to him, and he told me one of his best friends was opening up a restaurant and was looking for a chef. So I went and I interviewed with Derek, and it was the first meeting. We kind of knew, like, this is going to work. We want the same kind of things. We think about restaurants how they should be. We just agreed on everything.
Right. Wow. So, and did you have a test of cooking?
I never did.
Really?
You know, we just kind of trust on each other that he knew where I worked. He knew that we had a mutual friend. And I never, I think I worked for him for about a month before I ever cooked anything for him.
Wow. That's amazing. Wow. His vision, Derek's vision is strong. Yeah, and you were 24?
I was, 24 at the time.
Wow. Amazing. Impressive. Congratulations. And what is the concept of Uchu? Uchu means the cosmos or the universe, right?
It's on Eldridge and Lower East Side, which is kind of an off street. And you're walking through Lower East Side, and then when you step into Uchu, it kind of takes you away to a different world, a different space. That's kind of the inspiration behind the name.
Right.
It's kind of transportative to take you away.
That happens, really. Once you open the door, where am I?
Right. Perfect.
So what menu do you serve at Uchu?
So I say it's Kaiseki inspired. I'm very aware that I'm not a traditional Japanese chef, obviously. But I was so influenced by what I saw in Japan, and I wanted to kind of recreate that in a way in New York, but make it more approachable to New York diners.
Right. By the way, the Uchu has two sections. One is Kaiseki, where you cook, and only 8 seat, and kind of like a, L-shaped bar. And I really like that. It's kind of like a woody, dark.
Yeah, it's very intimate space.
Right. And so the sushi counter, 10 seats, sushi bar, it's by legendary chef Eiji Ichimura.
The master.
Right, the master chef. And he's amazing. How do you describe Kaiseki-inspired dishes? I mean, what's the essence of Kaiseki element, and what it's not, like your creativity.
Right. I try to follow the general format of Kaiseki in terms of the styles of dishes, the flow of the meal.
Which is for listeners who aren't familiar.
Right. So I kind of open up with a dish that is kind of meant to just be very impressive, moving into dashi course, sashimi. Do like a chopstick rest course, and then some grilled dishes, and then finishing with rice, donabe style.
Right.
So I kind of follow that format, but I'm always hyper seasonal. The menu's changing all the time. Whatever is in season, whatever purveyors are bringing in, I try to incorporate.
I think the biggest element of Kaiseki cuisine is the seasonality.
Yeah.
So that's really what you do. Right. And so this the Kaiseki tasting is $200.
$255.
$255.
Yes.
And I really thought it was so worth it, every single bite. Okay, so maybe you can tell us some of the signature dishes that you serve at this moment, this season.
Definitely, probably the biggest one is the caviar tamaki, the sushi hand roll.
That's the Siberian sturgeon caviar.
Yeah.
And then you serve at the counter.
Yeah. So that one's been on since day one, and it'll probably always be there.
Right. And the generous portion of caviar.
It's about 25, 30 grams.
Right. And then?
The other one I do is a soft scrambled Jidori egg with a golden trout roe. And then that one also has a pickle inside. So right now, summer is pickled tomato. In the spring, I was doing pickled white asparagus. I've done onion. I've done squash. Mm. Kind of whatever little element I can find to make it seasonal.
Mm-hmm. So umami, egg umami, yes. And the seasonal vegetable umami. Okay. And you're talking about the season, but local vegetables, what do you think is really fascinating? Like, you know, versus Kyoto kaiseki ingredients versus here, you are expressing, kind of creating your new own kaiseki, right? So what ingredients do you think is fascinating to you right now?
I think tomatoes are one of my favorites. They're really great right now. Eggplant is coming in. Squashes are starting, yellow squash, zucchini, fennel. That's kind of what I'm thinking about right now this season.
Right. So how do you utilize those, for example?
So right now, the final rice course is vegetarian. So it has a corn also. So grilled corn, grilled squash, grilled tomatoes, eggplant, all of that in one final rice dish.
So it's cooked in the little, a pot.
Yeah, the clay pot.
Right. Yeah. Must be really amazing. I have to go back. Right. Okay. And so in terms of seafood, do you get them from Japan?
Yeah, I use uni from Hokkaido. And then other, depending on what I'm using at the time. So right now I'm getting squid from Shizuoka. It changes all the time too. As other fish come in and out of season.
Right.
Aji is one of my favorites that I'll use when it's in season. I kind of play by ear.
Right. So aji, you cannot find anything similar here?
Not in my opinion. Not the same kind of delicate flavor that it has. It's a mackerel, so it has, a stronger flavor than most fish, but I think aji is... I don't know, the way the fat just balances with the fish is
interesting. And in terms of sea urchin, uni, to me, Santa Barbara or Maine, to me, it's like a Chardonnay versus Hokkaido sea urchin is like a Sauvignon Blanc.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you utilize the difference? Do you prefer Hokkaido uni?
I do. I think it's the most consistent. There's... Sometimes the Maine is very nice. There's probably a few weeks in the winter where it was incredible, and I was using it then. But when it's not in season, it's very much not in season. I think it shows more the differences.
Okay, right, interesting. I heard that you have a little rooftop garden.
Yeah.
At the Uchi.
Yeah.
What do you grow?
It's decent sized. So right now, blueberries, raspberries, strawberries, tomato, eggplants, shishito peppers, shiso, kinome, mitsuba, spearmint, chocolate mint, Thai basil, sorrel, probably a few other herbs. I can't remember right now.
Right. Maybe you can explain what kinome is for the listeners.
Kinome is the... basically the leaf part of Sancho pepper, which is the close relative of Szechuan.
Right, and visually it's tiny little leaves and flavor.
It gives like this almost electricity, a numbingness.
Right.
Yeah.
I didn't know. I never tried to grow it. Is it easy to grow?
Yeah, it is. I planted it last summer. And it sprouted a little bit, and then the branches kind of died in the winter because I had no greenhouse set up. But then in spring, it just came back to life.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I'll try that. How did you get the seeds?
I ordered online.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it came from a nursery in Oregon. And it's been doing great.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. So listen, it's kinome. Is really...
Yeah.
I would say next yuzu, kind of.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. It's amazing. It's,
yeah, it has a acidity, like a citrusy to it.
And visually pretty. So.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about the Wagyu sandwich restaurant, Don Wagyu, created newly by Sam. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Hey, this is Michael Harlan Turkel from the Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. I've been with the station for over 8 years, 350 shows, and it is the most consistent thing in my life. Every Tuesday at 3, I know to be here in studio, but I also get the privilege of meeting such amazing people, artists, artisans within the industry. I get to learn a new factoid, a new way of life from these wonderful people. And I hope you do too by listening and that you donate to our summer drive. Just go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate and click on the beating heart. And we'd even appreciate monthly recurring donations to any show on the network you could designate to the Food Scene, the Speakeasy, and that many more.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Sam Klontz, the executive kaiseki chef at Uchu in Manhattan's Lower East Side. And Sam earned his first Michelin star at the age of 25, only 5 months after the opening of Uchu. So now you have another restaurant called Don Wagyu.
Yes.
Which opened in Financial District in June. Mm-hmm. So what is Don Wagyu?
Don Wagyu has one focus, and that is Wagyu Katsu Sando. So we take Wagyu beef, bread it in panko, and fry it, and serve it on a sandwich.
Right. So sando is sandwich, mm-hmm. and it's, if you go to Japan and find sandwich, people call it something sando. Right. So, but why did you decide to open it?
It's something that I saw and had in Japan, and I thought it's uniquely Japanese, but it would translate well to American appetite. It just seemed like a natural idea.
Right. For listeners who are not familiar with the Wagyu, let's just talk about Wagyu quickly.
Sure.
So what is Wagyu?
I mean, directly translated, beef from Japan. Mm. It has more of a, I would say, colloquial understanding that it means highest end of Wagyu from, usually Miyazaki is the most common, but from all over Japan. Mm. And it's always on a rated system, A5 being the highest.
Mm. Right. And it's known for buttery, intense marbling.
Yeah, highly, highly intense marbling and fat integration.
Right. And actually, the ratio of the fat, that's unsaturated fat, mm-hmm. is higher, mm-hmm. so it's healthier.
Yes.
And I think the melting point, even, it's lower than mm-hmm. regular. And I looked up, and then the regular American beef has 86 Fahrenheit. And Wagyu can be 70 degrees. So it can melt in your mouth,
yeah.
and your hand even. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely richer, but the creamier mm-hmm. and more flavorful mm-hmm. because of the fat. Yeah. Okay. So what's on the menu at Don Wagyu, because you have one focus.
Right. So we have we focus on three different versions of Wagyu. I would say the lower end is a crossbreed. It's Woshugyu. So it's actually grown in on the West Coast. It's 50% black American Angus. And then it's crossbred with Japanese Wagyu. Mm. And then still raised in very much in the Japanese way of diet. So they're trying to create the same kind of marbleization, but crossbred with a black Angus.
Right. So, the Japanese Wagyu is known for really kind of spoiled mm-hmm. best ingredients,
yeah.
and then sometimes get massage,
yeah.
drink beer.
Right.
It's not a joke, but seriously. Yeah, yeah, we had a first guest talking about Wagyu, so, right. So, but this are the cross Black Angus and the Japanese Wagyu, 50%. Mm-hmm. It's called Washugyu, mm-hmm. right? So what's a flavor profile?
It's I think it has a bit more of a beefy flavor.
Mm.
I know that might sound
versus buttery.
Yeah. Mm. So it has a little bit more texture to it as well, because it doesn't have quite as high of the fat. But I would say it's much higher fat than most American beef.
Mm.
Even if you get the best prime steak, this has more fat than that.
Right.
More marbling.
Mm. Okay. And the second one?
Second one is A5 from Miyazaki.
Mm.
We use ribeye. And that's kind of the most widely seen Wagyu in New York and all over the country.
Mm.
It has a super high production and very consistent.
Mm. Okay. And do you work with a farm from Miyazaki?
So that's the third beef.
Oh, okay. Right. Okay, so let's talk about the third one.
Yes. The third one is Ozaki. Mm. And Ozaki is the name of the farm, and it's the name of the farmer.
Wow.
So he named his own farm after himself. And basically, he's a gentleman that takes a lot of pride in what he does. He's trying to take something that's already kind of perfected it and do it even better beyond that. So he has he takes things a little bit more serious. He does things a little bit differently than other people in the region.
Mm.
So most Miyazaki Wagyus bred to about 28 months. He goes to 36 months, just let them mature a little bit more.
Wow.
He says,
that's a lot of money for farmers, right?
Right. When you would think the sooner you can turn it into profit, the better. But he's willing to take the longer time to get the product.
Mm.
He says his diet feed is different as well, but that's all.
It's a secret.
Yeah, close secrets. And then he doesn't work with that many cattle. So he slaughters 20 cows a month.
Mm.
Five of them leave Japan. And right now we're receiving all five.
Wow.
At Don Wagyu.
Mm. Wow, it's amazing. So you had a special relationship with them.
Yeah. So Derek got the chance to go out to Japan, meet with him, kind of spend some time with him, eat some meals with them, and kind of secure and build a relationship with him so that he knows that all the work that he's putting into his beef is being appreciated somewhere else.
Mm. Wow. That's a very personal way of networking with the farmers.
Yeah.
Right? Because you have to convince the person it's going to be utilized the best way.
Right.
Right.
That we're going to treat it with as much respect as we can, not just, I don't know,
So no waste.
Yeah.
Respect.
Yes.
Right. So the who come to Don Wagyu? What kind of customers?
So we are located in the heart of financial district. So we get plenty of, you know, Wall Street workers. Mm. But we get, you know, all sorts of New Yorkers coming to see. Even tourists are already coming in. So.
Right, because I think the Japanese sando, the sandwich, is a little different, right? So the bread, I heard, is kind of Japanese-style bread.
Yeah, so it's traditionally a Hokkaido-style milk bread. We use a pandemi, which is very similar. It's basically a very milky brioche.
Mm.
So we're using that from Balthazar.
Okay, right. So what's the texture-wise, it's more kind of fluffier?
Yeah, very fluffy, kind of spongy, light, not distracting from the Wagyu.
Mm. So it doesn't distract the mouthfeel of the beef.
Right, yeah.
Right. And probably absorb the juice, the meat juice. Right. Okay, and what kind of sauce do you use?
We use tare. So it's a sauce that we make, has onions, ginger, garlic, soy, mirin, sake, and vinegar.
Mm. So that's the king classic.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So what's the reaction to the sando?
There's definitely sometimes a little sticker shock, but people who know what they're paying for and know what Wagyu really is and what it can be, they're very happy with it.
Right. So maybe it's a good timing that you opened because Wagyu is known and not known as a sandwich.
Right. Exactly. If it opened 10 years ago, before Wagyu had the kind of craze it's having right now, it would be a different story, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting because you're making Wagyu more accessible, approachable, right? Because you don't have to go to the steakhouse or expensive restaurant.
Yeah, you don't need a reservation. You can walk in, order it. You can get it delivered soon.
Right. Yeah, I think Wagyu is still premium in many places. And there's a Hida region in Japan. And Hidagyu is one of those Wagyu brands. And so there's Hida Takayama, that area, there's one shop. And it's just like casual takeout place. There's a long line because they have a nigiri of Wagyu. And I think it's like 7 to 8 to 10, like depending on the grade. And you don't have to eat a lot of it.
Yeah.
So it's the same idea, your sando and, the nigiri, sushi style Wagyu. You feel satisfied. It's kind of addictive. You learn about it. You look forward to eating it more. So that's a good way to educate people about Wagyu. Yeah. So, okay. So are you planning to expand the Wagyu?
There's always talks about it, but nothing in the works right now. Just kind of focus on... We're still new. It's only been open a month, and we want to make sure it's still running perfectly.
Right. And if you want to expand, you have to convince Ozaki-san to sell more cows.
Exactly.
Right? It must be already hard to. Okay. So, so what's your plan? Other than Don Wagyu, you're going to do Uchu differently or something?
Yeah. I mean, I'll always be at Uchu. It's, kind of my little project that I'm very involved with, but we're always looking for new things. I'd love to keep growing and expanding and opening up other places.
Right. So I can always, if our listener is a customer at Uchu, they can always see you, right, at the counter.
Yes, yes.
Right. Okay, yeah. So you have a very good smile. So I recommend customers and the listener to go to Uchu. All right. So where can we find your updates online?
I'd say on social media, Uchu's Instagram, mine, Don Wagyu.
Okay. All right. So thank you for joining us today, Sam.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, so good luck.
Thank you.
All right. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or akikatayama.com. And Japan Needs is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. And our engineer today is David Tatasur. And thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awali, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.